Welcome to the podcast series on sexual health for seniors with Dr. Sue Gledhill and Fran Carl. This podcast series is based on conversations with seniors about sexual health, sexual desire and related matters. In this session, we will be discussing Victoria and her experience of sexual desire in older age. Welcome, Fran.
Hello, Dr. Sue. So good to see you again. Yes. It's been a little while. I just wanted to say when I was reading Victoria's story, there was also end-of-life questions that came up in reading it. And I thought, oh, that's part of what I'm looking towards in my later years as well. Have I thought about it much? No. Right. So that was a really interesting, certainly looking at Victoria and what sexual health in her senior years has meant. Yes. But then having that other element was, no, I wouldn't say shocking, but it made me really think. Really think, have I made arrangements in my head without even talking to anybody yet? But have I done that? And the answer is no.
It's such a personal thing too, isn't it, Fran?
Sure is.
It's funny, just this very week, I've got a friend who has recently been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and another friend told me that that person was going to, through the normal channels, they were going to go for euthanasia. They live in Victoria. So.
Yes.
And the legislation is coming next year into Queensland.
Sure.
But I think that it'll be more restrictive, apparently.
Right.
Yeah, there'll be a lot of checks and balances, which may be a good thing.
Yeah, I don't have any problem with the checks and balances. That it ensures that it is voluntary and it's the person's decision, not someone who thinks they should.
I think that's right.
Really important.
Yeah, especially important with older adult children who stand to inherit.
Sadly, my adult children won't be inheriting much, but I'd still like to my own decision about this. Thanks.
Yeah, that's right. So let's introduce Victoria, who's the focus of this week's podcast in the Sexual Health for Seniors series.
Victoria was an attractive 79-year-old lady with a quiet, genteel manner. She had an ethereal appearance, being tall, slim, fair and pale. Yet there was an aura of great strength and resilience around her. Victoria's genteelness held both fragility and fortitude. Victoria was an intelligent, articulate lady who led a busy life filled with family, friends and social activities. Victoria's marriage ended after about 30 years when she found that her husband's predilection for alcohol and verbal abuse had become intolerable to a woman in her late 50s. Moving out of her beloved home was daunting and required considerable courage.
Yes, I think it did, Fran, especially for a woman of Victoria's era. You know, women didn't have many choices.
No.
They didn't usually earn an income or, you know, that is, again, generalising, but a lot of women didn't earn an income. And they were kind of in some ways forced to stay within a marriage, even if it was unhappy or, and even in some cases, quite dangerous to them, as we see even today.
Even today.
Yeah.
But the mindset was different, wasn't it?
Yes.
The expectation was that it was only relatively recently that when you were working in the public service, you could stay there after you were married. Mm. There had to be legislation brought that said married women can keep their jobs.
Yes.
Amazing. And it would appear that in Victoria's time, in the period that she was married, that didn't appear to be something that was seen as important to legislate for.
No, that's right. So it would have taken quite a bit of courage for her to move out. It was the same for me. My career was in nursing, as you know, and I trained in the early 80s, but it was only a few years before that that you had to live in the nurses' quarters if you were training. And if you were married, of course, you just wouldn't do nursing, I think.
No,
you
exactly.
You had to be single. Yeah.
I'm very glad that that has happened, that that change in mindset and that change in what is essential for members of society, regardless of whether you're a woman or a man.
Yes.
I think that's really important that it's happened, but it's so sad that it took so long.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Mm. So anyway, let's continue with Victoria's story. Victoria settled into a single life and after some years formed a new sexual relationship. The arrangement was not live-in. Victoria preferred to maintain her independence. Victoria recalled,
"He wanted me to marry him or live with him, but I had my father living with me and eventually we had to put him in a nursing home. But I also could see the writing on the wall in that I thought, well, I've been coping with Dad for quite a long while. I wasn't in love with this man. I was just very, very fond of him."
Victoria and her male friend enjoyed a sexual and companionable relationship for 10 years while living separately before Victoria's partner experienced a series of health problems.
"He was still chasing me around the bedroom at 80, but then he got prostate cancer, which didn't take him off, but then he had a couple of strokes."
Unable to cope with illness, ageing and loss of independence, her partner ended his life.
"He could not accept old age. and not being able to do all the things that he had done before, he couldn't cope. He topped himself. Yes, I don't think Victoria disclosed how he did that.
Mm.
I think it might have been either hanging or an overdose.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it is very sad. But I think the legislation that's coming in now, it does offer people other options,
yes.
doesn't it?
Mm. And the ultimate dignity for me is, yes. is choice. You see your life no longer worth living, or you are in pain, or any of those, to me, valid reasons for someone says, I don't want this anymore.
Mm.
To have legislation around that is maintaining the dignity of the human being. And that to me is absolutely paramount. Absolutely paramount.
That's right, it is. And I think the other thing is that because it has been so socially unacceptable, really, that people didn't tell people their intentions either, you know, to protect them.
Yes.
And if people wanted to help or that, then they didn't want them to get into trouble or, you know, to be seen to be in strife. So, there's a whole lot of restrictions around what people can choose to do.
Mm.
And we all have our own personal feelings about that and
of
thoughts
course.
About that too.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, I didn't realise, and I don't know how current this knowledge is, but I didn't realise that at the time, unless legislation was put in place, it was in fact a crime to take your own life.
Yes.
And so that those who were unsuccessful in taking their own life had the double whammy of being a criminal as well as, you know, a deeply unhappy or deeply disturbed or very ill person. I think that's not dignity.
That's
not society at its best, is it?
No, it isn't. Mm. And I think the other implication of that was maybe not quite right, but I think insurance policies weren't paid out on people who committed suicide. So the family would have been left bereft as well as poor.
Yeah, exactly. A horrifying situation. Horrifying.
Mm, mm. I think insurance policies have changed now. I remember the people talking about that the family wouldn't have any money if the person did kill themselves. So. Yeah, so there's so many issues around suicide and, you know, we've just seen a very prominent person in sport and people have said they just didn't see it coming.
That's right.
Couldn't see it coming.
Mm.
And yet when we think about this person who was 80, he may not have had too many people to talk to. But for younger people or relatively younger people, there are a lot of support systems in place
that weren't there in the past. In this period, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I only hope that people are aware of it and overcome that whole stigma of, you know, I do see it as a mental health issue and that whole idea of when you are considering that your mental health is at risk
of
one sort or another. So I'm hoping that we can turn the discussion generally in society around saying, and it is happening, I must say, but there will be some people who say, no, I'm not ill, I'm not crazy, I've just got a few problems. When it could be, if we step aside and say, yes, this is a mental health issue and you deserve to be given that support. That's the conversation turnaround I think we've got to have.
Yeah. Do you think that for an older person at 80, those sorts of support systems are fairly limited?
Fairly limited, yeah. Absolutely. In the meantime?
He could not accept old age and not being able to do all the things that he had done before, he couldn't cope, he topped himself.
Mm-hmm.
Victoria said that she intended to do the same in due course. However, now that voluntary assisted euthanasia will become available next year, an alternative option will be possible for her.
Mm.
Some of the medical profession often say palliative care is a good option, but the reality, I think, it's not always.
No, it's not always. And even in my own family where very senior members of the family have been so ill and so ill with cancer or whatever, and palliative care, while it is meant to be calming and loving and all of those sort of things, it really is not giving them living until they die, it's waiting until they die. And seeing the person not able to drink, it's far more distressing, I think, to go through that for everybody. So, yes, I just think we've got to do it better.
Yeah.
We've got to find a way to do it better.
Well, if you think about Andrew Denton, he's a strong advocate for euthanasia. And, and there's another journalist who is also a strong advocate. But I think there are probably thousands of people out there aren't captured within the statistics either.
True, absolutely true. So in the meantime, we're getting back to Victoria's story. Victoria enjoyed her solitary yet full life. At times, she experienced sexual desire.
Occasionally, I still feel the urge. And I look at some people sometimes and think, I wish I had met him if he didn't have a wife or attachment. I can look at somebody and think, it would be very nice to have some nice gentleman friend, but I mean, they aren't around and you don't want to get someone who is in poor health. I mean, the people of my age are not terribly well or they need looking after. I mean, let's face it, at 80, there are not a lot of men around. There are far, far more women. You know, I have fleeting thoughts when I meet people. Ones that haven't got wives are usually not robust by any means. I don't even envisage it happening because the age group is not right. You need to meet somebody younger, you know, who is fit, but then they would want to meet someone younger. But people do meet up in their old ages and so forth. The men that I meet are not so fit. Quite a few of those too have wives, and they are not very robust either.
Victoria accepted age and health-related changes and had adjusted to a celibate life. Victoria's narrative included personal experience of her close friend's physical decline and decision to end his own life. He had not been able to cope with the reality of older age and deteriorating health. Her friend made an end-of-life choice, and Victoria intended to exercise the same self-determination when the time came.
And as I said before, I don't think all the statistics are captured, or the reality of this are captured in the statistics.
Yeah, true, true.
Yeah. And in Australia, we also don't have the family support that a lot of other cultures
have. Yeah, the expectation that grandma and grandpa, well, no, we don't want them here because they're going to slow us down, and we don't. Mm. And there is that absolute separation. Mm. And as you said, in other cultures, all three, well, three, four, however many levels, but the three that we're talking about, you know, grandma, parents and the kids, they live in close company. They're expected that everyone's going to be assisting everybody else, learning how to live their lives and things. So, yes, I did grow up in a large family. My mum had six brothers and sisters, and every one of those were, should I say, good Catholic families. And there was always five, six or seven kids. And so at any one time, there'd be 30 cousins running around. And some of those became my friends, you know, on both sides, actually. So in that sense, however, from me, when I married and moved away from Brisbane, I didn't have anybody. Mm. I would be making friends and making contacts in the various places that myself, my then husband, moved to for work. Of course, there's a phone call, but who do you go to when your kid's screaming at 3 o'clock in the morning and say, "Mum, I need a break," you know? Of course, I'm not saying that mothers and parents should be unpaid babysitters, but that real need of social support and I've got your back, you didn't have it. You didn't have it. And that, I don't regret it, but I understand what difference it made in later years in my marriage when I thought, I need somewhere to go where I feel social support. And I went back home to Brisbane and re-established connections with my family. But I think it's something that was assumed in the 40s and 50s and 60s in Australia that everybody was going to be helping everybody else. And then in that 70s and 80s, the couples were moving away from family. And how that affects the grandparents now, I think we will be seeing a lot more of that. My generation and who were moving around in the 70s and 80s, I think we're going to see the effect on the grandparents who are now alone.
Yes. Mm. The social fabric has really changed over the last 50 or so years.
Mm. And I mean, it should. Yeah. It shouldn't stay the same, but I think we shouldn't be losing those good bits and the benefits and the things that makes it more socially cohesive as opposed to the separation.
I saw there's a new show starting about teenagers and older people getting together, and I think
that'll be a hoot to watch if nothing else.
Wouldn't it? And I think there's a lot of learning on both sides there.
Oh, yes, you bet. So, in summary, Victoria's biological experience of sexual desire involved living a solitary life with memories of an unhappy marriage and a shared sexual partnership in later life. The partnership had been sexually satisfying until her partner's deteriorating health had shifted the sexual relationship into one of companionship with occasional intimacies. After her partner's death, Victoria had been presented with a few opportunities for sexual engagement, but the approaches to her had been made by married men. Victoria admitted that she still had sexual urges, but that she wouldn't be interested in becoming too involved with a married man. Instead, she had accepted the life she had chosen to live, and in that sense, Victoria had reached a state of satisfaction. Victoria's decision to refuse marriage in later life was influenced by her abusive marriage. Thenceforth, Victoria preferred to control her sexuality and all aspects of her life by choosing to remain single.
And I think, Fran, there is that too, that if you have nursed someone through a long illness, and it would be very difficult to re-engage in a new relationship with the potential for that reoccurring.
Yeah. Absolutely. And that was another thing in Victoria's story. Is that all there is? Do you decide to be celibate? And I'm in my 60s. And I, in terms of meeting potential partners or potential companions, whatever, I'm not meeting many fit people either. And you think, is it harsh? No, I don't think so. I think it's being really sensible about what it is that you want to bring to a relationship. Mm. And if you immediately become a carer, when what you were looking for in a relationship. And in our probably our later years, we're much more focused on what it is that we'd like to be able to get out of the relationship, I think.
Mm.
Given, well, is it shortened time or better wisdom coming to it? I'm not sure. But in yeah. terms of if I had the prospect of becoming someone's nurse as opposed to becoming someone's partner or girlfriend,
lover,
where am I going to lean? Down that end, thanks. And yeah. It would be very sad if there is no one to care for these people. But let's say if there's a chap who is immediately really ill and there's no one else to care for it, I'm sorry, no, that's not what I'm here for. And I think that's really important to be able to make that distinction
yes.
because it is a major commitment when you become someone's carer.
Oh, for sure.
You know?
Yeah, for sure.
And I don't think anyone should take that on lightly.
No, no.
Really shouldn't. That was really interesting. As I said, when I was reading Victoria's information where she decided on a celibate life, I don't know that I have, but I hope it's not going to be forced upon me.
Yeah, yeah. She was a good deal older. Victoria was a good deal older than you. Yeah. That might change in some ways because, of course, we're much healthier now. We're
True.
Living longer. Mm-hmm. We're living healthier for longer as well.
True.
So
True.
The idea of expecting to become a carer, I think that will dwindle a little bit or extend mm-hmm. a little bit over time.
Mm-hmm.
But at the moment, it still often occurs when a person's in their 70s or even late 60s.
Yes.
Whereas in their future, that should
there
go
should
out
be, yeah,
a little
yeah.
bit.
Yeah, true. Because mm-hmm. I have become much more aware of what good health means for someone at my age and able to put in place strategies to maintain that, you know,
yes.
and make the decisions about being weller, well-being, and not only in a physical sense but also in emotional
and mental health.
And mental
yes.
health, yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm thrilled to hear, as we were discussing before, that mental ill health, that men's mental ill health is now being seen as a much more important topic for conversation.
Yes, and also extending out. I have a friend who does the psychs on bikes and goes out west with a group of
– Oh, wow.
And they go into farmhouses and talk to the men and all the women, but mostly the men. And those options just weren't available in the past, and it's wonderful to see that kind of – commitment from health professionals doing that
you bet.
Having a great time as well.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, for me, one of the best concepts that's come out, I don't know how long they've been, is it 5 to 10 years? The men's shed. Best thing.
Yes.
Just the best thing.
Yeah. And you know, that originated from 2009 when it was recognised in the government that there were women's health policies, that there was no male policy.
Oh, wow.
So the very first male policy was legislated in 2009, and the men's shed stemmed from that. Yeah.
Just the best thing.
Yeah, they really are.
The products and things that come from it is a separate level of benefit, but to have a place where a whole bunch of blokes can sit around doing things together, building things or talking about things. And, I mean, I've never been in a med shed. I wouldn't know what they talk about, but I think having that as a place to go where you do things together is going to be one of the ways to combat loneliness and ways to combat that idea of isolation and things. So I think
connectivity as well, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, without that a formal kind of a process or a doctor-patient kind of therapeutic relationship, it's mates and buddies and
I think have a hammer.
That's right. I think the men's shed has been a wonderful advent.
Mm.
And, of course, women are adopting that too. There are women's sheds becoming more available now.
Maybe I'll be able to learn how to do that, that corner cupboard in my kitchen.
Oh, well. Yes, yes. So you've been listening to Dr. Sue and Fran Carl, and we've been talking about sexual desire in older age. The focus this week was on an interview with Victoria and her experience of sexual desire as an older woman. One thing was certain, Victoria was determined to remain in control of her destiny. We'll continue with our series on sexual health for seniors in our next podcast. Thank you for being with us.